Welcome back once again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Well, they call it the D word, dioxin. In today's lecture, dioxin and related compounds, what we hope to do is actually give you a very, very in-depth briefing on this toxicant, dioxin, some of the controversy associated with dioxin and dioxin risk assessment, and also some of the clinical aspects in terms of animals and humans and their exposure to these chlorinated hydrocarbon compounds. Dioxin is associated with controversy. Its controversy lies primarily in the fact that it is an extraordinarily toxic compound when we examine its potential for toxicosis in animal tests. This has linked its management in environmental exposure to a significant amount of expense. For example, a complex multi-analysis dioxin residue screen in an environmental exposure scenario might be as much as $2,000 worth of analysis for one test. And so you can examine from this that some sort of environmental risk assessment associated with dioxin is going to be an extraordinarily expensive experience. Expensive as well in terms of the stress, in terms of public health risk communication to the general public. I was involved in the late 1980s in a risk assessment in Northern California, a risk assessment from a wood treatment plant that used pentachlorophenol, PCP, for wood post-treatment. This plant burned down. Dioxin is a combustion byproduct of chlorinated hydrocarbons, and there was great concern in the risk assessment community, governmental agencies, and in some activist groups about the potential for dioxin contamination in the downwind plume from this fire. As it turns out in the follow-up analysis, there was some evidence of fallout of dioxin and dioxin-like compounds. There was a series of public health discussions at local community centers, and there was a fair amount of, I would say, public health outrage from the citizens in the local communities, essentially feeling that they had somehow been poisoned by this very toxic compound. More recently in the news, you've seen that about 2 years ago, the presidential candidate and now president in the Ukrainian election, Viktor Yushchenko, was poisoned during his, I believe, 2003 campaign. His poisoning by dioxin is presumed caused the classic high acute dose chloracne, significant disfigurement that we've reviewed in prior lectures and will review once again today. Our learning objectives here today, talking about dioxins and related compounds, we're going to try to explore dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. We're going to try to do this by reviewing what we know and in a certain degree what we don't know about dioxins, especially the impact on a molecular basis and how that relates to toxicosis. We're going to try to summarize the structural similarities of the cogeners of dioxins and related compounds, the furans, the benzofurans. These are also chlorinated hydrocarbons that have a similar toxicological profile. We're going to try as well to understand the TEF, or toxicity equivalency factor, approach to dioxin risk assessment. This also involves the generation of what are referred to as toxicity equivalents. This helps us simplify the wide range of compounds, these dioxin-like compounds, and their risk assessment. As it turns out, dioxin is not necessarily one compound. We have a TCDD, a tetrachlorodibenzodioxin compound, that is the reference compound, but in fact, as we'll see here shortly, there is a full range of potential sites of chlorination on the dioxin backbone, and this allows us to have a more complex risk assessment because we are dealing with multiple compounds for dioxins, as well as we've introduced for PCBs, pentachlorobiphenyls. We'll try to have you summarize the known processes and toxicological endpoints for dioxin exposure. In fact, this is fairly timely because the National Academy of Sciences this past year has actually even charged the EPA to go back and look at non-cancer endpoints for dioxin and to do a more robust risk assessment, including the generation of reference doses, the same sort of reference doses that we talked about back when we were discussing pesticide risk assessment. We'll also try to have you describe this controversy and the data needs concerning low-level dioxin exposure. This is an active area, not scientific debate that dioxins are bad and they're toxic, but it's how bad and how toxic they are. At what sort of extrapolated levels, when we get into these low-level, highly toxic compounds, we're in the zone of extrapolation. And how do we use data that we have, data that we can produce, to do an adequate job of protecting public health while balancing against the data that we have and the relative risk versus benefits equation that we're going to use in public health risk assessment. We want you to be able to describe some of the observed effects and major findings in animal studies with dioxin, or have you summarize the environmental and food sources of dioxins. Remember, the lipophilic pathways throughout the environment and the human food chain. This is a lipophilic compound. It is going to circulate in the liposphere. It is going to be resident in our body fat. We'll have you summarize the known human risk estimations for dioxins. What we will do, even though the EPA is charged to reevaluate even their most recent 2003 reevaluation, we're going to have you at least address what is now EPA's findings, which is the 2003 findings in terms of dioxin risk assessment. We'll then explore and summarize the regulatory control approaches for dioxin release. Obviously, if dioxins come about via combustion processes, we're going to look at how we might control the release of these highly toxic compounds on a preventative basis in terms of managing processes like municipal incineration. Well, we have arrived at a dioxin controversy primarily because of organochlorines and their industrial use. Now, I need to preface this that we have observed the ability of nature to synthesize dioxins. And this can happen in soil, this can happen through normal and natural processes, because again, it is a chemical product. We do not use dioxins itself as a synthetic industrial compound. It is typically a byproduct. And it is a byproduct of various types of chemical reactions happening or acting on typically synthetic organochlorine compounds. When we look at these chlorinated compounds, these chlorinated compounds of interest are formed by combustion processes in the presence of chlorine. These are often nonpolar and therefore lipophilic, and they have the ability to be sequestered in fat tissue, and so it actually does circulate in what we have referred to again as the liposphere. Now, these organochlorine compounds have been related in a general way, chlorinated hydrocarbons, CHCs, to immune dysfunction, various neurological effects, cancer, endocrine disruption, and some other toxicological endpoints. Now, because of our use of chlorine in industry and just its appearance in the normal natural environment, remember that we have chlorine in salt water, sodium chloride. We also have an array of naturally occurring chlorinated compounds. But sometimes we find that synthetic organochlorine compounds, and because of their use and actually in various industrial processes like bleaching of paper and in various medical procedures in terms of disinfection, and then the waste management practices. Historically, it's been problematic in terms of incineration, that these organochlorine compounds, these chlorinated hydrocarbons, have proliferated into the environment as persistent bioaccumulative and toxic compounds. Sometimes the effects of low-level exposure to these chemicals are subclinical. In other words, they have a chemical level, biochemical level toxicosis, perhaps even on the cellular basis, but they are subclinical in terms of impacting endpoint toxicosis on an organism. So we're not going to necessarily see some of the aspects of toxicology, target organ toxicology, in low-level chronic exposure to dioxins. We have had episodes, and we'll review several of them, of high exposure associated with occupational exposure and in some curious sorts of industrial accidents that have allowed us to do a little bit better job of human health risk assessment associated with low-level or chronic exposure to dioxins. There's also been, for example, with the Viktor Yushchenko case, some case studies associated with high-level acute exposure. In 2003 and in 2006, the National Academy of Sciences actually did some significant analyses. And once again, the National Academy of Sciences, what they do is they call together a dozen or so of the leading scientists in the area. These are the premier brain trust scientists and perhaps occasionally policymakers associated with regulatory science, call them together and actually have them opine on a current situation. How are we doing? What do we need to do better in terms of the relationship of risk assessment in the government? In 2003, National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine published dioxins and dioxin-like compounds, these DLCs, in the food supply. I give you the link there. You can read that document. It's well over 200 pages long. But usually the summaries of these documents are very, very telling in terms of background statements and a snapshot of the current science when this particular book was written. Another one to look at is Health Risk from Dioxin and Related Compounds, Evaluation of the EPA Reassessment. This came out in July 2006. This was a review of EPA's reassessment, which was actually finally published in 2003. This reassessment by EPA was about a 3 or 4 year process, a very, very detailed reevaluation in terms of the existing literature at the time. It was interesting that in this 2006 reassessment, reevaluation of the EPA work, pretty much there was two major findings. One is, should we be calling dioxin as TCDD, tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, a known human carcinogen or a probable human carcinogen? The data is a little bit conflicted. We have some elements of data, but it is not as clear as perhaps we would like it. But even this particular group said, from a public health perspective, calling something a known carcinogen or a probable carcinogen really has very limited effect in terms of the management of exposure to that particular chemical. We deal, because we don't have a significant amount of data from human trials on many chemicals, we deal with managing risk by labeling certain chemicals according to their potential or probable toxic endpoints. The other area of concern in terms of this group examining dioxins in the current state of regulatory science was the fact that EPA had not done a reference dose calculation. It's one thing to look at the cancer aspects of a chemical, and there is significant amount of data to indicate that it is at least a probable human carcinogen and possibly a known human carcinogen. But there are also acute toxic end effects, such as the chloracne. But the findings of this particular group was that EPA needs to go back and establish reference doses. What is acceptable in terms of overall dose of dioxins, for example, in the human food supply? This reference dose calculation will be very similar to what we explored in Lecture 4 when we talk about the pesticides in the human food chain. The only other major finding of this particular report from 2006 was that EPA needs to do a better job in quantifying uncertainty. The reason I say that and expressly is because in our risk assessment lectures in this course, we will talk about methods to quantify uncertainty in risk calculations. Well, what are dioxins? They're widespread, they're low-level contaminants. They're found in animal feeds and the human food supply. So we are an exposed population. They are around us. And so it is in our best interest to quantify the relative risk of exposures and to have actions and activities associated with public health to monitor and minimize our exposure to dioxins. We find that animal fats are the primary vector of exposure of dioxins. They metabolize slowly and they do accumulate in our body fat over a lifetime. These are at least projected carcinogens, if not known carcinogens, and so this is of concern. There has been concern, for example, in the relationship of dioxins and these chlorinated hydrocarbons to occurrence or epidemiological occurrence of breast cancer, for example. The data show decline in levels, and so in our recent history, and we're going to talk about activities in the past decade or so, we have actually seen a decline in the levels of dioxins, our body burden, in terms of, for example, the fat that occurs in our blood. We have, in terms of a risk concern of dioxins, some level of concern about endocrine disruption. And we are also now concerned about exposure in children's health and development. There is a high public priority to reduce dioxin levels, especially in girls and young women. And this has a lot to do with the potential developmental effects and reproductive effects during pregnancy and prior to conception as well. Now we find in terms of the exposure side of dioxins that one of the vectors of contamination of production animals is airborne deposition on grazing areas. This airborne deposition can, for example, be a result of combustion processes and the release of dioxins from these combustion processes into the atmosphere. We have said that chlorine and chlorinated compounds are a major source material for the production of dioxins in combustion. When you look at all of the white paper in front of you, much of it has been bleached with chlorine. If that paper is combusted, there is a potential release of dioxins in that combustion processes. Trace amounts, but when you do a mass balance in terms of the amount of chlorinated compounds, we use chlorine bleach for many industrial processes. We use it in our home laundry. We use it for disinfection of our water. We generate trihalomethanes in wastewater. All of these things are a part of the potential impact of chlorine and its release into our environment. We do observe some geographic variability. We'll see some data that, for example, you will find in soils higher level of dioxin concentrations in soils nearby urban areas than, for example, rural areas. In human foods, we have a relatively uniform exposure, and this has a lot to do, at least in the United States, with our food distribution networks and patterns. Our grocery stores have a tremendous distribution network. We are eating food from all parts of the country. In fact, one might argue all parts of the world in these days of geographic distribution of food. So we do have, in terms of our exposure, a relatively uniform level of exposure, even though, for example, source materials might be more associated with industrial areas of the country. We do find a linkage between dioxin levels and food consumption patterns. If you are consuming a high-fat diet, you will have a higher exposure to these dioxin-like compounds. In animal fats, where we do find dioxin, full-fat dairy and fatty fish are some of the more important sources of dioxins. This slide gives the chemical structure of chlorinated dibenzodioxins. And again, what I want you to understand is that there is an array of conjugates. These conjugates actually have a result of the amount of chlorination on the dibenzodioxin structure. So we have this basic structure. This is the classic compound 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzoparadioxin. Also referred to as TCDD. It's important to know this because this is the most toxic dioxin that there is, and it is also the reference structure, when we start talking about toxicity equivalents, 2, 3, 7, 8 in terms of the chlorination pattern. I also want you to note the structure. This is not a three-dimensional representation, but this is, remembering freshmen and organic chemistry, going to be a somewhat planar molecule. Because it is a planar molecule, it has certain conformational restrictions. What's also quite interesting, if I put this molecule up against the estrogenic steroid estradiol, there is actually great similarity in not only the structure and size and conformation of the molecule, but also the electron distribution. This is one of the reasons people think that this is the, a good hormone disrupting chemical in terms of estrogenic effects. Now these PCDDs are polychlorinated dibenzodioxins. These are the various cogeners that we can find with this. And you notice in terms of the numbering system, we can have as many as 4 chlorines on this end of the ring and another 4 chlorines on this. And so the combination of chlorination on these polychlorinated dibenzodioxins give us a great variety in the chemical structures of this array of compounds. The other class of compounds, very similar, are the chlorinated dibenzofurans. The difference being is that we have a 5-membered furan group here in the middle, not a dibenzo, not a, a polyether, a diether compound. And this is 2378 TCDD, dibenzofuran, DF. So the DFs are the dibenzofurans, okay? And so the same way that we had the chemical variety for the dibenzodioxins, we have the chemical variety for the dibenzofurans. Now we've talked briefly about PCBs and their risk assessment in this course, and this is 334455 hexachlorobiphenyl, or PCB, one of the PCBs. So we have the same sort of array of potential chemical compounds in PCBs. So this, essentially what I'm trying to communicate here is that when we do risk assessment for these chlorinated hydrocarbons, we are doing risk assessment typically for an array of compounds. They can be monochlorinated, dichlorinated, polychlorinated. The other thing that's of interest is that because of the processes associated with environmental modifications in the environmental biochemistry that might happen in terms of the action of microbes in the environment, dehalogenation can happen. And so, for example, this polychlorinated biphenyl might lose electively these chlorines over time. This might, for example, change their disposition in the environment, make them more volatile, allowing, for example, airborne deposition from sediments. Some of the background in terms of totaling up all of the numbers, we have then about 75 dioxin cogeners and about 135 dibenzofuran cogeners, and so we have a fairly large array of chemicals. This makes for a complex laboratory assessment because we're not looking for one molecule called dioxin. Although I might tell you that tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, TCDD, this grandfather structure, 2378, is sometimes referred to dioxin, but it is more correctly referred to as TCDD because it is one of the dioxin structures. However, that being said, and you'll see this in a minute, our TEF, toxicity equivalent approach, will reference the toxicity of all these different cogeners to this parent compound. And that simplifies our risk assessment, and it's a good thing as well. In general, these CDDs, these chlorinated dibenzodioxins and the dibenzofurans, are present in human adipose tissue and bird and fish tissues at a sub-microgram per kilogram level. Okay, so when we look, we find them. They're there. Many of the actual isomers that we find are the less or relatively non-toxic isomers. In general, what we find in terms of classifying the toxicity on a relative basis is that the chlorinated dibenzodioxins are greater toxicity than the dibenzofurans, which are significantly greater in toxicity than PCBs. which are greater in toxicity than the chlorinated naphthalenes, where we just have a naphthalene two-ring structure. Okay, so this gives us an ability, and this is typically, in terms of relative toxicity, this is going to be acute chronic toxicity, because we typically don't rate carcinogens this particular way. In terms of approaches to risk management, what we do is we combine the risks from these dioxins because we have so many compounds, and we can do this because dioxins share a common mechanism of toxicity. This is somewhat similar when we started doing common mechanism of toxicity risk assessment when we did pesticide risk assessment, for example, in the neurotoxin organophosphate and carbamate pesticide categories. We invoke toxicity equivalency factors, TEFs, to compare the toxicity of the different dioxins. These TEFs are expressed in terms of TEQs, or toxicity equivalents. And just think about, let's simplify this down. We have two chemicals that are similar structure. One of the chemicals on a relative basis is half as toxic as the other. Right? So it's going to take twice the exposure of the less toxic compound to achieve the toxic endpoints of the more toxic compound. Magnify that throughout all of the cogeners of TCDD and dioxins and dibenzofurans, and you get a sense of why we're trying to do TEF-TEQ approaches to risk assessment. The TEQ, or the toxicity equivalent, is the amount of TCDD, this 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, this grandfather structure. So it's all relative. And it's the relative amount of this compound it would take to equal the combined toxic effect of all the dioxins found in that mixture. Okay? And so that's one of the ways we have chosen to simplify the risk assessment with dioxins. This graph allows us to take a look at how we might display these toxicity equivalency factors to calculate these TEQs. For example, we'll go to the dioxin side of this. This is the cogeners. So here's our grandfather 2,3,7,8 TCDD. We can just give it a toxicity equivalency factor of 1.0. So everything is relative to that. So you can see that the most chlorinated, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, that's the fully chlorinated, that's octachlorodibenzodioxin, is actually 1/1000 as toxic as TCDD. Okay? So although as we get to some of these less chlorinated, like the pentachlorinated dibenzodioxins, which are about half as toxic, you can see that it is a good approach if we have a quantitative analysis of, for example, the amounts of these different cogeners in a food, we can do a relative risk assessment talking about the relative TCDD toxicity. Over here, the same thing, same approach for these dibenzofurans. Notice that TCDF, 2,3,7,8 TCDF, the 4-chlorinated analog to TCDD, is about 1/10 as toxic as tetrachlorodibenzodioxin. Okay? And because these chemicals quite often are combustion byproducts, they occur together, we reference all of this to TCDD. And this helps us, again, simplify our risk assessment challenge. This approach to risk assessment is one that is done internationally. The EPA actually, in its 2003 reassessment, validated this. And in 2006, this reassessment validation was once again revalidated as a good approach by the National Academies of Sciences. This graph gives us a historical context for dioxin body burdens, kind of where we've come and where we're going, and it has a lot to do with these incidences over the past century or so where we've had occupation or industrial accident exposure to dioxins. We'll go through a little bit of a discussion of the incidents here, but to look at the dioxin body burden levels, these bars actually represent the body burden, and that's in nanograms per kilogram, and that's whole body 25% lipid normalization. These concentrations, again, nanogram per kilogram, this is a log graph, so we have 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000. Now, when we take a look at each of the individual bars, they represent different cohorts. In this first cohort, this is a background. This is the Centers for Disease Control did an assessment in 2000. Essentially, we're talking about an average in terms of nanograms per kilogram of, and these are, again, going to be parts per trillion if you want to convert it to the more informal units. That in the green part, this is the estimated background non-TCDDs, TEQs, and then the white is the component that is just, I'm sorry, the blue is the component that is the actual 2378 TCDD. But in terms of the averages, we're talking about less than 10 parts per trillion background in 2000 in the U.S. population. That's a significant improvement when they go back and analyze it against the 1990 cohort across the USA, where it actually had an exceedance of 10 parts per trillion. And so in terms of our understanding, our knowledge, and our regulatory science approaches to managing dioxin in the human food chain, we're doing good because we're having an effect of reducing those body burden levels. Now, the rest of these are associated with industrial accidents or occurrences in terms of high-level exposure. You'll hear me talk about Seveso. This was an industrial chemical accident from a pesticide factory in Seveso, Italy. There was the Seveso B population and then the Seveso A population. These are populations in the community around Seveso, the downwinders that were exposed following this industrial accident. What you can see is that their body burdens are fairly significant. The A populations here in this particular case had extremely high level exposures ranging up to 1,400 parts per trillion, 14 parts per billion, if you will, an average over 100 parts per trillion, and so a significant increase against at least the background when referenced against U.S. background numbers. But you can see that there is a distribution as you get away from the sites. The Seveso B populations were a farther distance away from the epicenter of the plume. These next two in here are called Operation Ranch Hand. These are low exposure cohort and a high exposure cohort. Operation Ranch Hand happened. It was in the Vietnam War. Some of you might have heard of Agent Orange. Essentially, what we used is 2,4-5-T, which is an herbicide in the 1960s. The industrial process to make 2,4-5-T was a fairly dirty process and had a significant amount of dioxin byproduct in there, significant in terms of human health risk assessment. The soldiers that were involved in the airborne spraying of this chemical, which was intended to defoliate swaths of jungle in terms of detection and management of the enemy, were exposed to significant amounts of this. And in terms of their dioxin body burden levels, you can see that there was definitely an elevation, at least relative to the 1990 and 2000 background numbers. There was another industrial accident in Germany in a BASF chemical factory, also a pesticide factory. These are categories of individuals that in this category, no chloroacne in this particular cohort, moderate chloroacne or the acne associated with high-level acute exposure of dioxins. And then this cohort, severe chloroacne. And you can see a dose response in terms of the clinical manifestation of acute dioxin toxicosis and the body burden levels associated with that industrial accident. So to go back and look at these case studies in terms of what gives us the background in human health risk assessment of dioxin exposure, in the 1940s and 50s here in the United States, you can read about Love Canal. This was in upstate New York. This was a hazardous waste landfill release. Hooker Chemicals was using a plot of land to bury waste chemicals from their manufacturing operation. Many of these chemicals were combined to cause dioxin release as well as many other chemicals. Unfortunately, they donated it as land for a park and a school. And it was right next to a housing subdivision as well before we knew much about dioxin risk assessment or chemical hazardous chemical waste management risk assessment. This was a perhaps less than desirable situation in terms of looking backwards in terms of how we handle and manage hazardous materials. In 1982 and before, we had what was referred to as Times Beach. This is Times Beach, Missouri. This is an unfortunate situation where some industrial chemical waste mix, primarily oils, were used to oil various streets in this community. They had dirt roads. This was in a way to use a cheap industrial byproduct to keep the dust down. As it turned out, the chemical mix they were using had significant levels of dioxins. We, being the taxpayers of the United States, had to go in and essentially buy the town of Times Beach. They closed it down, boarded it up, and essentially it was a devastating, if you will, industrial community accident. I talked a little bit about Agent Orange. Again, this was Vietnam era, early mid-60s, Operation Ranch Hand defoliation using 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, both chlorinated herbicides. 1976, I talked about the Seveso, Italy, and this also was 2,4-5-T, 2,4-5-trichlorophenol, industrial accident. And again, when we have these accidents and there's fire involved, the combustion processes lend a significant amount of high temperature in terms of the chemical reaction of these chlorinated hydrocarbons to form dioxins. The BASF industrial accident was in 1953. This again was chlorinated herbicides, and so we do have some significant level of exposure case studies with significantly sized cohorts. When researchers have gone back, now if you take a look, for example, at Seveso, Italy, this was relatively modern. We had at least the ability to do epidemiological monitoring in terms of, for example, reproductive impacts, cancer. The data is somewhat mixed in terms of epidemiological effects here several decades later. There have been some associations with adverse health effects, but perhaps not enough to be convincing in terms of dose response associated with carcinogenicity and other public health impacts. Now, in terms of the United States, our background serum, when we took a look at it in 1995-1997 cohort, the median TEQ, so this is the total equivalence of dibenzofurans and dioxins. We had about, and this is in units of picograms per gram of lipid, and so we're back calculating this not to total blood values, but for the lipid concentration, because it's found in lipids in serum. The median was 18, the mean was 22, 95th percentile, 38.8 picograms per gram. If we looked at just the 2378 TCDD in terms of picogram, about 2 picograms for median and a mean. What we found that in this analysis, when we did dietary estimations, the adult background intake was about 70 picograms of toxic equivalents of dioxin per day. Okay, so that's the daily exposure of this group of chemicals. Now, what we find is that TCDD is characterized as a known human carcinogen according to the current dioxin risk assessment from EPA. Now, the other dioxins, the non-2378, are characterized as likely human carcinogens. The 2006 reassessment found no problem with the other dioxins being characterized as likely human carcinogens. There was a significant debate whether or not TCDD in of itself should be classified as a known human carcinogen or as a probable or likely human carcinogen. The split decision indicates that the risk assessment is exceptionally difficult for this chemical because of the very low levels it is known to cause disease. What we found find is that at least currently EPA's standing is that it is a known human carcinogen, and it is at least a likely human carcinogen. And so we do need to know that there is a difference in TCDD as a unique chemical, as a human carcinogen, and the other dioxins in terms of their likely human carcinogen status. We find in terms of dioxin toxicity that dioxins can alter various growth and development of cells. There's impacts that can result in terms of adverse effects upon various reproduction and development in organisms. In terms of its impact or toxic endpoint, we find that these chlorinated hydrocarbons have a direct potential on suppressing the immune system, so we can refer to them as immunotoxic. One of the more visible manifestations of acute high-level dioxin exposure is a syndrome called chloracne, and this is a severe acne-like condition. I've shown you this picture before. This is a most recent 2003 picture of Viktor Yushchenko in terms of dioxin poisoning during the Ukrainian presidential campaign. What do we know about dioxin exposure? We know that they're highly persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. About 95% of the dioxin intake in a typical person comes through dietary intake of animal fats. And so in terms of risk assessment, there's perhaps another reason to examine your fat consumption in your diet. In terms of low exposure vectors of dioxin exposure, we find that breathing air can contain trace amounts of dioxins. Some folks can ingest dust or soil that contains dioxins. We've discussed here the importance, for example, in lead toxicosis and blood lead levels in children. It's because toddlers are crawling on the floor, their hand-mouth activities lead them to actually consume on the order of a milligram or two or three or four or five, depending upon the size of the child, of dust per day just from the floor. If that dust contains toxins such as dioxin, there is a potential exposure. We can have absorption potentially through the skin in terms of contaminated air, soil, and our water containing various minute exposures levels. But primarily, we are concerned about food exposure. Various environmental processes can result in this low-level exposure of the general population. But what we've found that the regulatory science, the academic science, and published peer-reviewed literature in terms of the risk assessment and risks associated with dioxin in public health have led to a significant amount of control in the environment. It's control in terms of discharge permits for water pollution and for air pollution. What we found is that there has been a response in terms of environmental levels and also in human tissues. The dioxin emissions in the United States decreased by about 80% between in the decade 1987 to about 1995. And so this is a clear-cut sort of risk-benefit determination that allowed the regulatory agencies charged with protection of public health to take action. Those actions obviously cost money in terms of emission controls, but there was clear benefits. We'll go through some of the changes in the decades in later slides. In terms of the U.S., the general population body burden in terms of chlorinated dibenzodioxins and the dibenzofurans range from about 8.5 picograms of toxicity equivalents per gram of liquid lipid to about 50 TEQs per gram of lipid. The mean in this is about 21 picograms TEQs of dibenzo dioxins and furans, and this is in 1998 general population body burden data. General population intake data in terms of the U.S., the estimates is that we get about 41 picograms of TEQs per day, or about, and that's in terms of TEQs of dioxins and furans, and about 0.59 picograms per kilogram of body weight per day is about what we get in terms of our dosage. In the U.S., the if you take a look at the total chlorinated dibenzodioxin, dibenzofuran, and PCB exposure, if we bump in some other categories of chlorinated hydrocarbons, the estimate jumps up to about 65 picograms per day, or 1 picogram of TEQ per day, per kilogram per day. In children, the estimate is that they're being exposed to about 54 picograms per day, or about 3.6 picograms per kilogram per day. What we find is that, and this is relevant to dietary patterns in terms of body weight and exposure, that this will decrease for age, because on a body weight basis, children eat more on a relative basis than adults do. As it turns out, when we do these analyses, we actually break out the different particular compounds. About 5 individual compounds make up about 70% of the body burden load. These compounds include the 2,3,7-8-TCDD, the grandparent, the pentachlorinated dioxin, and the pentachlorinated furans. Hexachlorinated dibenzofuran and PCB number 126, one of the cogeners of PCB, the primary one. And PCBs were an industrial chemical, unlike TCDD. PCBs, and we're not really discussing them in too great a detail today, but PCBs were used as a dielectric in transformers. They were used in copy machines. There were because of it was a liquid insulator, if you will, and a liquid dielectric. It had many properties, and it's still, in fact, even though it's been banned from industrial manufacture and use, it still is with us today because of its persistence in the environment. Now let's review some of the dioxin effects in humans. What we find is that the amount of dioxin found in various tissues of the of humans, their body burden, in terms of the EPA risk assessment approaches, and this is within a factor of 10, the levels at which adverse effects can occur. And so although these numbers are in the picogram parts per trillion level, we had discussed that the potential for toxicosis at very low levels is significant. And so the risk in terms of even having these low levels is of concern in terms of risk assessment authorities. There is no clear linkage, however, between these concentrations and some sort of risk for increased disease in the general population. And so there is obviously a disconnect in terms of the risk assessment process, perhaps limited understanding of the uncertainty. We know that the concentrations are high enough that we can have these toxic impacts, but we don't necessarily have a cause and effect, and this has a lot to do with just the challenges of risk assessment at these very, very low concentrations, as well as the impact. Carcinogen risk assessment is extraordinarily difficult because of the long amount of time between dose and potential response. We're talking about, in some cases, decades. In terms of the EPA reassessment in 2003, they found that there was an increased chance of experiencing cancer rate, and that was between 1 in 100 and 1 in 1,000 increased chance related to dioxin exposure. The cancer risk indicates that in 2000, because of the reassessment and the new knowledge we had about carcinogenicity of this compound, there was about a tenfold higher chance estimated in 2000 than in the previous assessment in 1994. You can probably expect this to change. And this change is not because we don't know what we're doing in terms of regulatory risk assessment, but it's because new data in terms of peer review science, new data in terms of clinical case studies and exposure, new data in terms of epidemiological monitoring are actually brought into the new risk assessments. So in this process, we are refining our knowledge and we're refining our approach to risk assessment of dioxins. One of the other approaches to risk assessment dioxin is to focus on children. And if you recall our discussion about the National Academies of Poor Report of Pesticides and the Diets of Infants and Children, in the early 1990s, it was the first time we actually started a refocusing of regulatory risk assessment, not on human adults, but on human children. The other aspect of the risk assessment is to focus on specific concern groups. Sometimes these can be occupational exposures. These can be selective populations, for example, populations infirm, immunocompromised, or other individuals that are in special categories. One of the special categories is the U.S. Air Force personnel exposed during the Agent Orange operations in the Vietnam War. You will still see on a fairly regular basis risk assessment, epidemiological analyses, follow-up reviews of this cohort, this population of exposed individuals. We also actually update and refocus our risk assessment in terms of follow-up of industrial accidents. You can look through the literature and still find very recent scientific analyses of Seveso, Italy, and the follow-up analysis of those. And we are also examining subpopulation in groups that have unusually high consumption of fish, meat, and dairy products, some Aboriginal populations, for example, Alaskan Native Americans, that consume high levels of marine animal fat in their diet and therefore have a potential vector of exposure to dioxin and dioxin-like compounds. I've tried to introduce that, in fact, dioxin risk assessment is full of controversy. The controversy is a part of the scientific assessment, reassessment, and analysis in terms of modulating, moderating public health aspects of dioxin and its exposure. Part of the problem that's associated with dioxin and dioxin's impact on biological systems has to do with the array of biochemical effects, these subclinical effects that we see on dioxin exposure. When we look, we find them. There is a question, for example, of whether or not enzyme induction and various indicators of altered cellular function are significant indicators of toxicity. Or is that just the organism, the organelles, and the cells responding to a chemical exposure in the very same way that various cells respond in terms of biotransformation responses, for example, to oxidative stress? So is this any different? Is this a toxic endpoint in and of itself, a cascade effect, if you will, that's going to lead to some toxic outcome? Or is this just the body, the organism, adapting to a chemical exposure? This is a point of challenge. It's gotten perhaps even more complicated as we have become better at examining molecular biology, genetic responses to toxicants, interactions of chemicals on a cellular basis and not necessarily an organ or organismal basis. In terms of a case study, I thought I'd break it up here with a relatively recent case study. This is 1999. It's referred to as the Belgium incident. It was a fairly devastating incident. In this particular case, what happened was there was a livestock food supply mill that used rendered fat for as one of the ingredients. This is relatively common as a calorie booster in animal production animal livestock feed. Unfortunately, the truck that was transporting the rendered fat, someone had also used it to transport waste industrial oils. Some of the waste industrial oils were transformer oils that were highly contaminated with PCBs and dioxins. This was an unfortunate situation because the rendered fat then took on this load of PCBs and dioxins. It was mixed into animal food at a mill that serviced a tremendously large clientele of livestock and animal agriculture in Belgium primarily, but also in other parts of Europe. Veterinarians and animal managers noticed that with the poultry, there was a reduction in egg hatchability, there was reduced weight gain and increased mortality. There was an edema, and there's a classic chlorinated hydrocarbon veterinary toxicology profile called chick edema that's associated with chlorinated hydrocarbons. And so the veterinarians supervising these operations were very sharp in noticing chick edema and coming up with a diagnosis of potential chlorinated hydrocarbon exposure. Ataxis, or a paralysis or inability to walk, was another clinical sign or observation in these poultry. Essentially, what they did find was that PCBs and dioxins had entered the human food chain through these animal products. In the whole episode, and this include not only animals but meat products, 60 million kilograms, that's 120, 150 million pounds of animals had to be destroyed because of contamination of their body fat with PCBs, with dioxins. There was an international meat product embargo, not only on Belgian products, but some of France and Spain and some surrounding countries because of cross-border shipments of livestock, cross-border shipments of feed and food products. If we take a look at the data, this graph gives you kind of a broad relationship. This is dioxins and PCBs in the original feedstuffs. What we've done here in this graph is put log of the PCBs, and this is micrograms per gram of fat. And so this is essentially in a part per million, micrograms per gram, a part per million domain. This is a part per billion, a picogram per gram of fat for dioxins. And so what we saw is that there was a very definite evidence of a co-related contamination. This is a nice linear line, essentially suggesting that the feedstuffs were contaminated by a material that contained a fairly constant ratio of dioxins and PCBs. When we take a look at that and how it developed in terms of body fat, we see a very similar slope and linear relationship. Again, the PCBs and the fat in this particular diagram is for chickens. And this is dioxins, again, parts per billion in fat. And so we're seeing about one part per billion, two parts per billion in fat for dioxins, and about one or two parts per million of PCBs in chicken. And so in a certain sense, these animals that grow up on feed become their feed in terms of the bioaccumulation impacts of these lipophilic compounds. This was devastating not only to the animal industry in this part of the world, but also to the consuming public because meat products were out on the market, they were being consumed, and these are relatively high concentrations in terms of potential public health impacts. Well, let's take a few moments here to go back and review the clinical pathologic concepts associated with dioxin exposure. Most of this comes to us from animal studies. There has been over the past several decades a significant amount of research associated with chlorinated hydrocarbons and dioxin in particular. What we find is that the syndrome induced by chlorinated dibenzodioxins in a given species of animals is comparable to that that's introduced by the full range of chlorinated hydrocarbons. And so that's why, for example, the veterinarians in the Belgium case observed chick edema, and so they were initially thinking chlorinated hydrocarbons. We have this classic clinical syndrome. The pathogenesis of the disease is the same, so this suggests that these chemicals, these chlorinated hydrocarbons, these dioxin-like compounds, involve the same biochemical receptors. In terms of exposure, typically we find that exposure can be by a mixture of these isomers and various compounds, so usually it's not a dose response with a unique isolated chemical, and this is also one of the reasons why we have fallen back to toxicity equivalence in terms of risk assessment and management in terms of exposure. is best to view dioxin exposure and chlorinated hydrocarbon exposure as in terms of the etiology rather than a specific insult. So there is a collection of syndromes associated with acute or chronic exposure of this relative class of compounds. What we find is that the syndrome varies from species to species. The skin of primates and rabbits in terms of ears and control test, cattle and some mice show this characteristic chloracne or follicular dermatitis that we've seen in this particular disposition. There's a photograph in the used textbook of a child impacted with chloracne. This is a somewhat reversible lesion, although it is a skin damaging episode. In terms of outcome, there is a greater concern about long-term potential for cancer than for even a mildly disfiguring acne. We find that the livers of chickens, rabbits, mice show necrotic response of lethal severity. Guinea pigs, cattle, non-human primates show an enlarged liver, some epithelial hyperplasia of the bile duct and gallbladder. And so there is apparently some tissue damage, some acute damage to various tissues. This is high-level exposure. This is not chronic low-level exposure. Some of the animals show various epithelial lesions in the gastrointestinal tract and in the renal tract. Again, these are typically resulting from test animal experiments that occurred primarily in the 70s associated with trying to come up with a risk assessment for these chlorinated hydrocarbons. We find that in terms of the syndrome, the one organ that uniformly shows lesions in all species is the thymus, and this is probably the linkage between these chlorinated hydrocarbons and their immunotoxic effects, because the thymus is a primary organ in terms of the development and maturation of various immune-type cells. In lethal intoxications, the thymus often weighs about 25% of normal. And again, because it is the site of formation of these lymphocytes and antibody production, it is probably the linkage between dioxin exposure, chlorinated hydrocarbon exposure, and immunotoxic effects. We find that severe intoxication in birds is accompanied by this fluid accumulation that has been termed chick edema. We find an interesting feature in animal studies associated with TCDD, and that is that the total dose of TCDD required to produce disease is less if the dose is spread over time than if it is actually given to a single dose. This has a lot to do with potential adaptation, various receptor sites, and how we biotransform and actually metabolize the particular chemical compound. The LD50s are the risk driver in many risk assessments, and it's no different in terms of dioxins. For TCDD, this is again tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, the LD50s are significant in that they are quite low. The units here are micrograms per kilogram, so this is a part per trillion. So these are very small doses, I'm sorry, part per billion. And so in terms of a lethal dose for 50% of the population in pigs, that's the most sensitive animal, and risk assessment is driven by the most sensitive species, the lethal dose is 600 parts per trillion, or 0.6 parts per billion. In avian species, they're classified as very sensitive. There's no exact number. It does range. You can find various test trials across different species. In the rat, our classic comparative toxicology species, about 22 to 45 parts per billion, different than mice, which is up to 100 to 200 parts per billion. Rhesus monkeys, somewhere less than 70. In rabbits, about 115. But then we jump in hamsters to 5,000, so we're getting up into the part per million range. This diversity of species response is a part of the controversy associated with human health risk assessment. If we see this high variability in terms of comparative toxicology, remember that we use comparative toxicology in human health risk assessment. We do this with safety factors, but we do it off of the most sensitive species. And so what the question arises in terms of discussion of risk assessment of dioxins, what happens if in fact the comparative toxicology is wrong in this particular case, that in fact we're more like hamsters than we are guinea pigs or pigs. These questions are out there in terms of are we being overly conservative in our risk assessment of dioxins. However, note that this is a risk assessment based on LD50, the lethal dose for 50% of the population. Most risk assessors would argue that the driver in risk assessment for dioxin is not lethality from acute exposure, it is from cancer risk assessment. What we find in terms of observations, and this is from controlled studies and field studies, is that young animals and females in general may be more susceptible to intoxication. In neonatal death, we find neonatal death, poor survival of the young, female infertility, and reproductive failure is indicated by some of the problems that we observe in field studies associated with chlorinated hydrocarbon exposures. At lethal dose levels, the time between exposure and death for dioxins and chlorinated hydrocarbons is unusually long. In the guinea pig, rat, and mice model, that's 2 to 3 weeks. Given the lethal dose, death doesn't come for 2 to 3 weeks, and this is atypical. In monkeys, it's about 6 weeks. This suggests that there is probably some bioactivation or cascading of effect of these chemical compounds. We find that except for animals with severe liver necrosis, and this includes the chicken and rabbit animal model, the cause of death is not usually attributed to a specific organ or system pathology. So again, it's a syndrome, it's an etiologic combination of impacts, and in general we can classify this as a wasting disease. In terms of how these animals die over weeks, it resembles starvation, anorexia. In environmental exposures with these chlorinated hydrocarbons, we find that the disease is also complicated by the immunotoxic effects and opportunistic infections. So the animals may not die directly of the exposure, but indirectly by infectious disease. In terms of studying the metabolism of TCDD, we find that in rat and dog studies that the major metabolites are hydroxylated compounds. Remember that in phase one biotransformation, phase two biotransformation, we are trying to turn grease into salt. TCDD as a nonpolar chemical is a very greasy chemical. It's very lipophilic, and so you would imagine that hydroxylated compounds would be a fairly reasonable biotransformation product. Most of the compound administered in control studies is eliminated as the parent compound in the feces. We find that chronic rodent bioassays and life and short-term studies have addressed various issues of tumor initiation, promotion, co-carcinogenesis, DNA interaction, mutagenesis, and clastogenesis, or the breaking of chromosomes. And so we see all of these potential impacts. The dioxin literature is very large, if you will, if not thousands of papers associated with dioxin, metabolism of dioxin, and dioxin risk assessment. If we try to summarize some of the major findings associated with carcinogenicity and mutagenicity in some animal studies, these are doses from 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per day to 0.001 in the rat, and these are Sprague Dawley rats. What we find in terms of responses is hepatocellular or squamous cell carcinoma occurring with an increase in dose in the mouse. We find these hepatocellular tumors and thyroid tumors in mice as well in a dose-dependent response. And so we do see in animal models the mutagenicity and carcinogenicity of these TCDD chemicals. In terms of the mechanistic analysis of toxicity and carcinogenicity, again, this is an active area of study trying to decode the molecular, biomolecular pathways of carcinogenesis and toxicity. In general, what the findings will tell us is that you'll observe an alteration of the cell membrane function and cell-cell communication. There seems to be some effect on vitamin A function. There seems to be an enhancement of membrane lipid peroxidation, some therefore potential in terms of oxidative stress that we discussed previously. There's an impact on thyroid hormones, there's an impact on hormonal levels, and there appears to be some DNA modifications. Some experiments suggest generation of superoxide, and so the potential for oxidative stress, and initiation of peroxidation by ferrous iron. So there is, via oxidative stress and the generation of free radicals, the potential for liver damage, the liver being our primary detoxification organ and the primary synthesizer of the molecules to support life. This is obviously one potential pathway for toxicosis. We find that TCDD inhibits hepatic selenium glutathione peroxidase. If you recall from our discussion, in oxidative stress, selenium glutathione peroxidase is the primary antioxidant enzyme that actually manages the superoxide that is generated in respiratory processes of aerobic organisms. We also find a reduced level of glutathione. There is in terms of the findings of animal studies, a relationship between glutathione peroxidase activity and survival. So if, in fact, we can manage the generation of these free radicals generated in these hepatotoxic events by dioxin, there is a potential for survival of the organism. We do find that lipid peroxidation is an important endpoint in the toxic pathway of dioxins. This fairly comprehensive list would probably be better served to put a diagram in here, but in terms of the folks that study the molecular biology, the cellular biology of dioxin exposure, they've come to some sort of agreement of some of the early molecular events. Dioxin will diffuse into the cell. There'll be a binding with the aryl hydrocarbon receptor protein. And so this is one of the reasons, this AHR, this receptor protein, is why we have a very similar syndrome or etiology of all of this class of compounds of the chlorinated hydrocarbons and hydrocarbons, is because they all impact the same protein receptor. There is a dissociation associated with heat shock protein 90. There is an active translocation from the cytoplasm. There's an association with a aryl hydrocarbon nuclear transport protein. There's a conversion of a liganded receptor heteromer to enhance DNA. There's an enhancer activation followed by some altered DNA configuration. There's a histone modification, recruitment of additional protein, nucleosome disruption, increased accessibility of transcriptional promoters, binding of transcriptional factors to promoters, enhanced messenger RNA and protein synthesis. And so you do see molecular events, you see a cascade of responses. There's still, in terms of the risk assessment community, the molecular toxicology community, trying to decipher all of these molecular level events and relate them to risk assessment, to relate them to further intoxication in terms of cascade at the organ or organismal level, including the potential for carcinogenesis. This fairly broad table gives us an array of the effects of TCDD and related compounds in terms of all of the potential toxic endpoints in various species. Across the top, in terms of species, we have humans, monkeys, rats, fish, avian wildlife, marine mammals. Down in this axis, we have enzyme induction, acute lethality, wasting syndrome, teratogenesis, mortality, endocrine effects, immunotoxicity, carcinogenicity, neurotoxicity, porphyria, and hepatotoxicity. What you can see as you scan this is that predominantly where you see something in here where we have a little bit of data, primarily we see a plus sign indicating that there is a relationship, a known relationship of TCDD and this observed toxic effect. In humans, the difference is that it may or may not be. The data is not as clear, again, because we do not do toxicological trials in humans. But in general, the range of toxic endpoints is pretty clear in terms of TCDD, and a preponderance of those endpoints have in fact been observed in humans. Now let's shift over out of the clinical and molecular biology aspects of dioxin into the environmental exposure, the environmental transport, and the environmental source of dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. We find that the major source types include combustion and incineration sources, some of these also coming from metal smelting, refining and processing, chemical manufacturing and processing, various reservoir sources such as soils, because soils and microbes in soils have been found to be able to generate naturally occurring dioxins at very low levels. There is also a potential for biological and photochemical processes. There has been historically and currently, in the past couple of decades at least, significant regulatory pressure to limit release, and this has a lot to do with the toxicological profile, the potential for carcinogenicity of these chemical compounds, and more than anything else, that they are preventable in terms of the major pathways of human exposure. If we take a look, and this is in relatively recent history, these are TEQ of dioxins, furans, releases in the air in the U.S., and this is over 1995 to 1997, so we see two columns of number on this particular graphic. The graphic, what it does, it goes through the grams of TEQ per year, and this is from incineration processes. You can see that just by taking a look at this, that the major 1987 vector in terms of generation was in fact municipal waste incineration at about 9,000 grams of TEQ per year across the U.S. Reduction efforts via regulatory science pressure, regulation effects down to 1,200 in 1995. Medical waste incineration, pathological incineration also because of emission controls reduced as well. Not so much reduction in terms of forest brushing and straw fires because those are quite often naturally occurring, so there's real no regulatory limitation other than burn bans associated with trash burning. In the cement manufacturing process, we use a high-temperature kiln. That kiln takes and essentially calcines materials close to 1,000 degrees. Because of natural byproducts that might occur in the natural materials, there is a potential generation of that. The amount of TEQs coming out of cement kilns actually showed a small increase, but this is probably more due to the increased number of cement kilns. We also find sewage sludge incineration, crematoria in terms of mortuaries, hazardous waste incineration, tire combustion, cigarettes as well, having some sort of TEQ release to air. In terms of power energy generation, and this has a lot to do with transportation like vehicle fuel and as well coal combustion as being kind of major vectors. What we found in 1987 that we're talking about unleaded and diesel fuel in terms of the challenges because we got rid of leaded fuel, the change was significant in terms of a reduction. There hasn't been a necessarily reduction but an increase, and this is due to higher levels of oil consumption in terms of vehicle transport. In wood combustion, residential and industrial, we see a small change, not particularly significant. We do see a fairly large change in terms of industrials and utilities, about by half in terms of point source. From a regulatory point of view and a regulatory science point of view, we find that it is often a lot easier to manage a point source than a one single factory, if you will, than many different sources or broad, widespread sort of agricultural impacts or residential impacts. In terms of releases to air, the total quantified releases, 1987, about 13,000 grams of TEQ per year. That was reduced over the next decade or so down to 2,700. So obviously that is a big impact. So you can read between the lines there that there has been a tremendous amount of enforcement effort in terms of legislating new emission controls and putting stricter regulations in terms of factory emissions. Where those emissions come from, if we look at major sources, bleached wood pulp and paper mills, 1987, 356 grams of TEQ to water in terms of releases to water. The reduction was down to 20, and this was by a change in the bleaching process associated with pulp and paper manufacturing, a significant reduction overall. In terms of land releases, this is disposition of waste materials to land, similar sorts of things, and this has to do with the management of chlorine in industrial processes and industrial byproducts via regulatory pressure. Overall, a little bit of a reduction, but again, what we find is that airborne release through combustion incineration is the primary release change over the decade monitored here. In terms of releases overall in the United States, 1987, 13,000 grams of TEQs per year, down to about 2,800 in 1995. A significant challenge in terms of the application of regulatory pressure and the expense associated with minimizing release and therefore having a potential impact on the public health. There are many other unquantified sources, just to be fair and where all of this comes from. It's not all from incineration. There's some uncontrolled combustion of PCBs. There's agricultural burning. There's various mining and smelting operations because of their high temperature. Chemical manufacturing for various phenolic compounds, pentachlorophenol, chlorobenzenes, chlorobiphenyls. Various dyes, pigments, current manufacturing of the popular herbicide used by many homeowners, 2,4-D. Various liquid soap manufacturing also is associated with chlorinated hydrocarbon generation. There are some biological and photochemical processes associated with composting. Composting in terms of municipal waste management associated with what happens when we flush, what happens when we put our garbage out at the street corner, and where it ends up in terms of waste management. There are also some reservoir resources out there in terms of the background that's in air, sediments, water, and biota. So overall, what we saw was an 80% decrease between 1987 and 1995 of these dioxin and chlorinated hydrocarbons to air, water, and land. Again, due to reduction primarily in air emissions from municipal and medical waste incinerators. The regulations promulgated in 1995 for municipal combustion and 1997 for medical waste incinerators also should have some effect, but nobody has tabulated them. That tabulation should probably come out in the next few years because it's been about a decade. The various control efforts for air, how did we do this? This came about, and we'll discuss the whole environmental law landscape in one of the lectures here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology. But we get a lot of this through the Clean Air Act and its amendments, which require emission limits based on maximum achievable control technology. There were changes in 1995, 1997 for medical waste incinerators. The Clean Air Act and RCRA, the Resources Conservation and Recovery Act, do authorize regulation of emissions from facilities that do burn hazardous waste. Some of this hazardous waste is chlorinated, and therefore the potential for formation of dioxins and PCBs and byproducts from combustion is there. Typically what we find is a 99.9999% reduction in terms of what's allowed out of the combustion stacks. The control efforts for water came about through the Clean Water Act. It manages releases through risk-based and technology-based tools. The 1984 ambient water quality standard for 237A TCDD was a guidance for state water quality criteria in the development of NPDES permits. These permits that allow for people to discharge contaminants, very low level typically, contaminants into natural waters. Pulp and paper facilities were a big target because of the use of chlorine bleach in their processes. The 1998 Clean Water Guidelines will take that down even further. This industry has been a major leader in reduction of release of chlorinated hydrocarbons into the environment. The NPDES pollution discharge elimination system also places stringent performance on dischargers because they have to come up for permit reevaluation every 5 years. So a new risk assessment is required. Adoption of new control technologies is also typically required. In 1992, there was an MCL goal, non-enforcement regulatory limit of zero. And so the goal in terms of discharge elimination was to eliminate dioxin discharge, although it was a non-enforceable goal, and typically permits were written as no greater than. The Safe Drinking Water Act, which does manage municipal water or communities larger than 25 people, has an MCL, an enforceable level, of 3 × 10⁻⁸ milligrams per liter or parts per million for tetrachlorobenzodioxin. Some of the control efforts for land came to us through RCRA and also through Superfund, which is the CERCLA body of legislation, and we'll go through hazardous waste management in our environmental law lecture. These came to us as a result of incidents like Times Beach and Love Canal. What these two episodes in American environmental history did for us is demonstrate that we really did not have a good approach to managing historical hazardous waste, that might be decades old, abandoned factories, abandoned waste dumps. CERCLA Superfund helped us establish a federal fund to go back and use taxpayer resources to clean up that in terms of risk mitigation and protection of the public health. We have various hazardous waste identification and disposal rules under RCRA. These are sometimes referred to as cradle to grave. If you are a hazardous waste generator, you own it forever under current law. TSCA, or the Toxic Substances Control Act, authorizes restricted use of dioxin-contaminated pulp and paper sludge. And so there is a management and enforcement criteria associated with paper and pulp mills in terms of managing their chlorine output and especially their dioxin output in their facilities and operations. In 1999, we had enhanced regulation to limit dioxin content of cement kilns and sludge from various facilities associated, and these are publicly owned sewage treatment facilities, and the sludge and sludge management associated with what happens again when we flush. We also have some control efforts in terms of these chlorinated hydrocarbons for various products. For FIFRA, we have, and this is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, there is some control elimination of certain chemicals, 245T. If you remember, that's the chemical from Agent Orange, and PCP were actually banned or severely limited in terms of their application and use. And chemicals do come under review in terms of the risk-benefit of their use. And I would tell you that a chemical or a manufacturing process that has the potential to contaminate the environment or the human food chain with dioxin is going to be severely limited or banned. In terms of our background, environmental media, when we go out into our backyards, if you will, and look around for the toxicity equivalents, the concentrations in picograms per gram, and again, these are parts per trillion in various environmental media, we find that rural soils about 1 to 6 parts per trillion, urban soils about 7 to 20 parts per trillion. Again, just the industrial processes, the incineration processes associated with urban environments. Sediments can contain 1 to 60 parts per trillion. Rural air is significantly lower than urban air, which contains about 0.02 to 0.2 picograms per cubic meter of air. This is where we focus our risk analysis, risk mitigation effects in terms of dioxin. This is keeping it out of the food system, since this is the primary vector of exposure. This list gives you relative estimates. This is out of an EPA analysis of the total picograms, TQs, of a fresh weight per gram, fresh weight in food. You can see that here off the top that beef, pork, eggs, the livestock, dairy products, animal products have significant concentrations relative, for example, to vegetable fats and water. When we take a look at this in terms of percent contribution, and this is for children in this particular figure, 1 to 5 years in terms of doing an analysis of dietary exposure, you can see that the two major segments here include dairy foods, about 30% of the contribution, and animal meat at 35% of the contribution. And so these are the dietary vectors of exposure of dioxin intake. In terms of the body burden changes, we've come a long way, if you will. In the late 1980s, cohort analyses showed us that Americans had about 30 to 80 picograms of TEQs per gram of lipid, about 30 to 80 parts per trillion. The midpoint was about 55 or so picograms of TEQ per gram of lipid. Some of the high-end estimates for certain subpopulations may be as much as 3 times higher, and this has to do with cultural and regional and influences in terms of dietary influences, fat in the diet. In the late 1990s, the chlorinated dibenzodioxin, dibenzofuran, PCB body burden dropped significantly to about 25 parts per trillion, and again, this is on a lipid basis. And so we're about half or one-third of what we were in the previous 10 years. And the big challenge that we still have with dioxins is how to do adequate risk assessment. Again, the controversy of whether or not receptor binding and some of these early biochemical events are likely or not to demonstrate low-dose linearity. If they do demonstrate low-dose linearity, then the risk assessment processes that EPA has done is reasonable, and the probability of cancer risk will be significant to these very low levels of exposure. One of the challenges that EPA puts out is that we do need to understand these mechanistic relationships a little bit better. That currently the shape of the dose response curve is only can only be inferred with some degree of uncertainty, and this has a lot to do with extrapolations of the low dose data that we find in many aspects of risk assessment and dose response generated risk assessment. Well, what this does is give you, again, what I hoped or promised for you in this lecture is a broad-based background of dioxin, dioxin chemistry, environmental transport, exposure, risk assessment, its clinical pathology, and some of the challenges that we have in terms of managing dioxin exposure in the human environment. This is an area that is active in terms of risk assessment research, trying to understand this chemical, especially 2378 TCDD, and its interaction and its molecular biology. And I think we're learning much about interactions of toxicant on a molecular basis in organisms with that. Until next time, we'll see you again. Thank you so much.